are perfectly credible but have ended up becoming neglected because of the preoccupation that exists with genetics. And there's also a more abstract way to frame this talk, and that's thinking in terms of how does science become racialized. And I take inspiration here from two philosophers, both of who were with us this morning, Lawrence Bloom and Sally Haslinger. And they have developed a notion, an attempt to address some of the questions that came up in the first talk. What kind of kind is race? And they've developed this theory of racialized groups. I hesitate to describe this in Sally's presence, but the basic idea here is that the issue is not really primarily whether races are actually different or not. The issue is that they are treated differently, and the ways in which people from these different groups are treated has real consequences, social consequences and biological consequences. And if you link up this notion of racialized groups with a theory that's been produced by epidemiologists or anthropologists on embodiment, you can come up with a very elegant solution. I'm not sure if it's the right solution, but a very elegant solution for how to think productively about race. And the idea here is that because social and environmental exposures are very structured by race or ethnicity, and these exposures can become internalized and embodied in various different physiological mechanisms, people of different races can end up with different biologies, not because they were intrinsically different at the outset, but because of the racial structuring of our society that influences their exposures. And through this, it provides a way of thinking how bodies can become racialized without really being different races. There's a parallel story there, and the analogy doesn't work perfectly. I'm trying to figure out how to get this right. But how does science itself become racialized? Basic idea is there was not necessarily any particular reason for science to latch onto race as the obvious category of analysis, but it has happened time and time again for different reasons. And specific case studies exist. So Jonathan Kahn, for instance, has done the best work on Bidel, showing how the drug itself was developed, a combination of two pre-existing generic drugs. Initially, it was intended for use in all patients. So when the early research was done on Bidel in the 1980s, there was nothing racial about it. But over the course of the 1990s into the 2000s, Bidel got rebranded as a racial drug, approved for people who self-identify as black for very specific commercial reasons that relate to U.S. patent law. So that's a case of how a drug became racialized. Stephen Epstein's study of NIH policy does the same thing for science more broadly. How is it that American biomedical research has become racialized? Many things have contributed to that, but with the reforms of NIH regulation in the 1990s, NIH researchers must now consider race. That will now become a fixed part of the knowledge production in biomedical sciences in the United States because of this law. The science has become racialized. And so these sorts of studies show how something that wasn't necessarily or even initially a racial category has become a racial category for reasons that can be explained and understood by historians, anthropologists, and other social scientists. I want to provide a case example looking at pharmacogenetics more broadly. And I can only sketch out the very brief details in the time allotted here. But I do this by looking at one of the pioneers. This is essentially a biographical story. And so if you look at people who have written histories, and these are usually the practicing pharmacogeneticists reflecting on the history of their field, they almost always identify the same three people, all of whom were German scientists, all working in the 1950s, as the three founders of pharmacogenetics. And Werner Kallo was one of them. And he worked for decades, from his early work in the 1940s, to show the relevance of both genetics and race to answer this question of why different individuals respond differently to drugs. And he remained active in the field until his recent death in 2008. And his work has had a very long legacy for this field. And by looking at his early career especially, you can see the different types of evidence and the different styles of argument that he used both to geneticize and to racialize the science of drug response. And understanding this historical context can bring attention back to the other possibilities for personalized medicine. So that's a very long-winded introduction to this. For my purposes today, you can start the story in Berlin in 1947. It was a very interesting prehistory I could talk about if people are interested in the questions, but we'll start in 1947. Now, in the chaos of post-war Berlin, two patients who were treated at one of the hospitals associated with the University of Berlin died after being given routine doses of Novocaine. So Novocaine is a local anesthetic. I suspect most of you have had Novocaine at some point in your life. Two patients died after a routine dose of this drug. The professor of pharmacology at the University of Berlin was concerned and interested into why this had happened. And he had a particular theory. There was widespread famine and malnutrition even as late as 1947, 1948 in Berlin after the war. It took a long time to get the city back on its feet. And his theory was that the widespread malnutrition had left these patients deficient with some crucial drug metabolizing enzyme. So their malnourished bodies didn't respond to this drug in the same way that healthy bodies would have responded to this drug. And that left them newly susceptible to the toxic effects of Novocaine. And so he assigned the problem to a young pharmacologist there, Werner Kalla, to try to understand what had gone wrong. Now, just recently, in 1946, 1947, American researchers had identified a specific enzyme, which they called procaine esterase. Procaine is the generic name for Novocaine, that metabolized this drug. And Kalla had access to a very cumbersome laboratory apparatus. It required a room full of equipment and a physicist on loan from the U.S. Army to run this device. And he would use this to study the metabolism of this drug. And he realized that this one enzyme, procaine esterase, metabolized a whole series of different local anesthetics. And it metabolized the different drugs at different rates. And so that suggested to him that the enzyme had a different affinity for these drugs. It bound some drugs more tightly than others, and the tightness with which it bound the drug determined how quickly it metabolized them. Through a roundabout way, he was able to get a fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania, and so he moves from Berlin to Philadelphia, where he has access to much, much better scientific equipment. What required a room full of equipment and a physicist in Berlin, he was able to do with a desktop device in Philadelphia. And so he continues to do very detailed studies on enzyme metabolism and on the metabolism of various anesthetic agents. And he realizes that he needs to learn something about biochemistry, so he gets tutored by the local biochemist there, and learns that the affinity with which an enzyme binds to a drug depends on its structure. So he realizes if different people have different enzyme activities, they must have enzymes with very different structure. As soon as he gets set up there, he ends up having to relocate to Toronto. And part of the issue here was this was during the Korean War, and even though he was a German national, the U.S. policy at the time was to draft all physicians regardless of their nationality. So even as a German physician on fellowship in Philadelphia, he was at risk of being drafted into the U.S. Army. And having been drafted into the German Army during World War II, he had no interest in serving a second time. So he was able to get a faculty job in Toronto to dodge the U.S. draft. And he continues his work there. And while he's in Toronto, he learns of a very interesting group of patients. Now in the late 1940s, early 1950s, there was a psychiatrist at a local asylum there, Donald Gunn, who was a pioneer in the humane use of electroconvulsive therapy. When this treatment was first done in the 1930s, it would be done on unanesthetized patients who would lie down, they would induce the seizure, you would pass out from the seizure, but the experience was quite painful for the patients. And what Gunn realized is if you gave the patients muscle relaxants before electroshock therapy, it was a much more benign experience. The seizure would be confined to the brain, you wouldn't get any of the fierce muscle contractions that you would experience from a generalized seizure. So Gunn starts using a particular muscle relaxant, succinylcholine, to make shock therapy more tolerable for his patients. And because of the nature of this therapy, he would have patients in this asylum for months or for years, and would be doing the treatment repeatedly, 10 times, 15 times, 20 times, over the years on these patients. He got a very good sense of how these patients and how different patients responded to this drug. The drug appealed to him because it has a very short half-life. So you give the person a standard dose, they'd be paralyzed for 5 or 10 minutes, you would do the shock therapy, and then they would recover, and you could send them on their way. But he realized that he had several patients, three in particular, who had prolonged paralysis. Instead of being paralyzed for 5 or 10 minutes, they'd be paralyzed for up to an hour. And this was both terrifying for the patients, because they would recover from the seizure, they would be awake, and they would be paralyzed. And it was also a nuisance for the staff, because they were paralyzed, they couldn't breathe, and so the staff would have to use would have to hand ventilate the patients until their breathing recovered. So it was a high maintenance problem for the staff there. So he realizes this is an issue of anesthetic metabolism, realizes that Kalla is there with his expertise in anesthetic metabolism, and the two of them get together to do a long-term research project on drug metabolism in the psychiatric patients in this asylum. And Kalla realizes the initial hypothesis was that maybe these patients had a deficient level of the enzyme, the same idea that had motivated the work back in Berlin. And they quickly realized that the patients had normal levels of the enzyme just was not particularly active. So again, these people had something, there was something structurally wrong with their enzyme, such that it didn't metabolize this drug properly. And what determined the structure of an enzyme? It had to be genetic. Enzymes are encoded by proteins, the sequence of the protein is determined by the sequence of the DNA, if there is a genetic problem, if there is a structural problem with the enzyme, the answer must be genetic. And so this was a very different style of argument than most genetic claims that took place up through the 1950s. Typical claims of genetic causality had been based on tracing traits through family trees. You would see a trait in one generation, you'd see it in the second generation, you'd see it in the third generation, and you would determine that trait was under genetic control. Callow was doing something very different. He was using pharmacological techniques to show differences in enzyme structure, and then arguing that that necessarily meant some kind of underlying difference in genetic sequence. And he was doing this work in the roughly between 1953 and 1957, which was an extremely exciting time to be getting interested in genetics. This was right when Watson and Crick described the structure of the double helix. Callow was able to go off to conferences where he was presenting this work, and he was surrounded by the people who are now the towering figures of 20th century genetics. So it was a very exciting time for a young scientist. He begins to read widely in the field, looking for all possible evidence of genetic determinants of drug response. He realizes that these other German scientists were doing work, one of whom, Friedrich Vogel, coins the term pharmacogenetics in 1959. Callow decides to write this up as a textbook, and so in 1962, he publishes a textbook, Pharmacogenetics, Heredity, and the Pharmacology of... If anyone's interested in the reference, I can give you the full reference, but he publishes this book, the first book published specifically on this on the topic of pharmacogenetics. That fall, when he's publishing this book, he gets invited to speak at a conference in the New York Academy of Science. And it's amazing how different New York Times coverage is. So there was this obscure scientific conference at the New York Academy of Science, gets picked up by the New York Times, who publishes not just an article about the conference, but also a full-length editorial about Callow's work. The New York Times editors were quite interested in this, and they alerted its readers to the importance of genetics to drug response. They say differences in genetic makeup between individuals make for radically different degrees of risk in taking drugs. So the idea was every individual is genetically different, therefore we had different risk. This was coming right on the heels of the thalidomide controversies. The Kefauver hearings were ongoing during this time. So many people were interested in these sorts of questions. When he published this book in 1962, Callow was aware of six drugs for which a genetic basis had been determined for the drug metabolism. So a small sample size on which to make a claim of the universal importance of pharmacogenetics. Over the next 17 years, only two more examples were found. So enormous interest in this field, but very little empirical basis behind these claims that genetics is the central issue for pharmacology. Now during this period where he's working on this, between the 15 years when he starts off in Berlin to 1962 when he publishes this book, as Callow had become interested in the genetics of drug response, he also becomes interested in the racial aspects of drug response. And the story here emerges out of a line of work that has begun on animals. And as Callow does his review to write this book, he realizes that going back to 1852, a Viennese researcher had observed a group of rabbits that happened to survive living on a field of belladonna. Now, belladonna is also known as deadly nightshade. It contains a particular compound, atropine, which would be lethal to most animals. So if any of us were to have a salad made of belladonna, we would have severe physiological effects, might even die from doing so. But this one population of bunnies was alive and well despite this. And so researchers became curious. It took them a long time before this was replicated, but by 1910 they realized that some rabbits, but not all rabbits, had a special enzyme, atropine esterase, that most mammals did not seem to have, that allowed them to survive on this diet of deadly nightshade. 1943, researchers characterized this more carefully, and their language was explicitly the language of race. They're talking about races of rabbits. And this relates to that question earlier, you know, should we switch away from using the word human race to using breed or something else? This sort of confusion is endemic in the field. And so what do they say? They say, well, a New Zealand white race lacked the esterase completely. Other strains had it in many individuals, and still others, including a pure chinchilla race, produced both enzyme-producing and enzyme-non-possessing bodies, bunnies. The pattern suggests the existence of racial differences, at least among rabbits. So there's all this discussion of the rabbit races and their responses to this drug. Other researchers saw similar things in other species. A group of environmental toxicologists were doing studies on chemotherapy agents in the early 1950s. They look at one drug, thiourea, which is still occasionally used for chemotherapy, Harvard rats could tolerate a dose of 44 milligrams. Hopkins rats could only tolerate a dose of 4 milligrams. This was not a function of Harvard stalwartness. Some wild type Norway rats could tolerate a dose of nearly 1,400 milligrams. When a laboratory catastrophe at the Jackson Labs in Bar Harbor released coliform across their mouse colonies, mortality rates varied between 0% and 74% across the different strains of mice. As Callow later describes, the more precisely one measures the effects of drugs in laboratory animals, the more likely one is to find differences between strains. So Callow becomes very aware of all this evidence of strain-specific differences in the pharmacology of relevant drugs. And he had even seen some differences in his own work. When he had done his initial work on Novocaine back in Berlin in 1947, he'd been doing comparison studies of humans and horses. It turns out Novocaine was being used as a doping agent in competitive horse racing. So it was a great concern for horse racers in this time. He had done work on that. Same thing happens with morphine when he's on Toronto. Again, morphine, turns out, excites horses and was being used for drug doping in horse races. Everywhere he looked, he found species-specific differences in drug response. When he was doing his work on procaine esterase, he showed that humans, horses, rabbits, and monkeys all had different levels of activity. Other species, like goats and cows, had none at all. Well, then the question was, would similar differences exist between human groups? And again, several examples exist in the medical literature. The number of examples was small, but these were all high-profile examples, and the most famous one was the case of the African-American soldiers during World War II who developed hemolytic anemia after being given primaquine for malaria prophylaxis. Very rarely seen in white patients, it was much more commonly seen, or in white soldiers, much more commonly seen in the black soldiers. And this got written up in the 1950s as a prominent example of a race-based difference in drug response. Now, Callow was very interested in these suggestions of racial specificity and drug response, but his frustration working in Toronto in the early 1950s was he had access to only very limited diversity in his human research populations. Basically, everyone he had access to was of Northern and Western European descent. And so he'll say in one study, I had patients from Canada, Great Britain, Poland, Ukraine, Yugoslavia, Russia, France, Italy, Austria, Germany, Hungary, and 30 other one countries, mostly European. When he did these comparative studies, he found no differences in enzyme activity between them. And he didn't give up his faith that there would be differences in human populations. He just said the problem was the homogeneity of his research population. He was very excited in the few cases he found of unusual activity. He said we had an opportunity to observe atypical esterase in one Arabian family and one Persian family. Still stuck with Caucasians, but you know, the hope was there for him that if they looked broadly enough, they would find evidence of racial variation in this. And he was convinced that these racial differences would be important medically. When he presents his work at the New York Academy of Sciences, again, it gets picked up by the New York Times. In the case of the widely used anti-tuberculosis drug isoniazid, experience has shown that there are marked genetic differences between large populations. That's why almost all the Japanese and Eskimos are in the category of those who may experience adverse side effects of this drug. Only half of white Americans fall into this group. So the thing that was seen by the New York Times as the most interesting part of his work, the thing that gets the most discussion in this editorial, was the very thin evidence based on basically two human cases of, not two individual cases, but two classes of drugs for which these responses were relevant. And the New York Times gets interested. Callow's faith that race differences would exist emerged in part from his analogy to the differences that he'd seen between races of bunnies or the interspecies differences between various animals. But it also emerged from an evolutionary story that he was able to tell about drug metabolizing enzymes. Now, the basic story here was that no one thought that these drug metabolizing enzymes had evolved to metabolize drugs. These enzymes must have had some function in the human body before there was Novocaine, before there was morphine or anything else. And the assumption was that these drugs all had evolved to metabolize environmental toxins. And so we're exposed to all sorts of things through our environment. Our liver has these complex metabolic pathways. The idea was all of these enzymes' primordial existence was to metabolize environmental toxins. And so therefore it would make sense, to the extent that different species are evolved in different environments, that the drug metabolizing repertoire of each individual species would be slightly different based on environmental specificity of each different species. And then the same thing you could possibly go for subspecies or strains or breeds or races, whichever phrase you're going to use, to the extent that any group evolved in a unique setting, you would expect it to have a unique collection of drug metabolizing activity. And he said this was just like any other example. And the links between sickle cell and malaria had been proposed 1954, 1955. So all this stuff was in the air as he was working on it. And he said this is no different. Just as any other gene is under natural selective pressure, so are our drug metabolizing enzymes. He did admit to one caveat, however. This is a funny quote. He says, "The genes which determine the pattern of adaptability of drug metabolizing enzymes must be expected to be under different kinds of selective pressure than the genes which can convey visible racial characteristics. Physical appearance may certainly affect mating instincts, but it is reasonable to assume that there was never a marriage made on the basis of a partner's rates of antipyrene metabolism." Even though he had very little empirical data to support this interest in his initial work in the 1950s and 1960s, Callow continues to pursue this actively through the 1960s into the 1970s. He participates in some of the first global surveys of human enzyme variation between various populations, initially finds very little evidence of significant race-based variation in drug metabolizing enzymes, but as he looks hard enough, eventually he does find some. He gets a position as the chair of a WHO scientific advisory committee in the early 1970s that was focused specifically on the public health consequences of this new evidence of racial differences in drug metabolism. The basic idea here was one that you'll hear about a lot in the literature today, was that drugs that work well in one country for its population might not work well everywhere. And international groups, whether it's WHO or the pharmaceutical industry, needs to be aware of these racial differences. Now, as he was doing this work on race and drug response in the 1960s and 1970s, Callow was extremely aware that this was very politicized science. He wrote in 1975, "The whole genetic area has been politicized by the concept of race. While most geneticists would see races merely as statistical entities representing higher than usual concentrations or of a high proportion of certain configurations of genetic information, the general public does not share this view." So for the public, these things were much more complicated entities. Scientists just saw this as, you know, it's just variation. There's nothing exciting here. Basically, the public is all bent out of shape about race. And his articles about race and drug metabolism in the 1970s and 1980s, he often bent over backwards. And I could, again, go into this in the questions if people want to hear the full details. But he was very apologetic whenever he would produce racial findings. He would say, you know, "We did a study on a group of University of Toronto medical students. We had no interest in race. We did the study. When we published the results, or when we analyzed the results, there was one group that seemed to be different. And lo and behold, when we unmasked the blind, we realized that these were all the Chinese medical students, and these were the Canadian medical students, and these differences were there. We weren't looking for them, we just found them." Which was not quite what was going on. He had been actively looking for evidence of racial differences for 20 years, maybe not in that particular study, but that had been the focus of his career's research. And time and time again, in the articles he publishes in the late 1970s into the early 1980s, he's always doing something to make it seem as though he was just a scientist doing the scientific thing, just happened to stumble across all this evidence of racial difference. And by this point, he was very happy to benefit from the increasing demographic heterogeneity of Toronto. By the 1970s, it was a very different city than it had been in the 1950s, which really made this work much more possible for him. And these sorts of things dog him to the very end of his career. So by 2002, he had long since retired from the faculty, but got angry on behalf of one of his junior colleagues. So one of the young pharmacologists at the University of Toronto gave what Callow considered to be a very routine lecture to the first-year medical students. It was their lecture on pharmacogenetics and ethnopharmacology. And this professor gave the lecture that she had always given, describing how different races responded differently to medications. Chinese respond one way, Africans respond another way, Caucasians respond a third way. Nothing surprising to her. But as Callow wrote in a letter to the editor of the local newspaper, "This time the students were outraged. The professor was shocked to experience ugly protests by some students who called her a racist." Callow submitted a letter of editorial protesting this, saying, "Look, all this professor was doing was describing the facts. This is an issue of science. This is not an issue of politics. This is just how it is. This is a scientific issue, not a political issue." So again, this is a very brief gloss on Callow's career, but I've been trying to show some of the ways in which Callow worked to make a case both for the significance of genetics and the significance of race to pharmacology. And over the course of his career from the 1960s to the 1990s, he becomes the leading proponent of both of these issues. But Kahlo, throughout his career, was very aware of other models of explanation. Now remember, when his mentor had assigned him the problem of procaine esterase in 1947, the original hypothesis was that this was a nutritional problem. The initial theory was that these patients were malnourished, and that's why they were susceptible. And throughout the 1950s, as Kahlo is doing his work on genetics, he's in communication with the scientists who are doing work on a completely different project, which is tracking the environmental determinants of drug response. And some of this is the prehistory to the work that Tsar has been looking at on environmental toxicology. And so starting in the 1950s and picking up steam into the 1970s, researchers are doing a wide range of studies documenting that pesticides, cigarette smoke, and even diet can have a significant impact on drug metabolism. And Kahlo was very much in dialogue with these researchers. And some of this work was quite interesting. Researchers in London, for instance, in the 1970s were interested in what was going on with all these people from the former colonies who were moving into England as a result of decolonization. And so there are many comparative studies of the drug metabolism of South Asians in London and Londoners in London. And there were all these reports that there were very wide differences in drug metabolism. Some intrepid researchers decided to go back to the source, so we go back to the home communities of a lot of these immigrants in India or in Sudan or wherever they were coming from. And what they were able to show is that the reported differences, racial differences in drug metabolism, actually had much more to do about diet. So when people moved to London from Sudan and India, if they maintained their traditional no smoking, no alcohol, vegetarian diets, they had one way of drug metabolizing. But if they assimilated into the British culture of smoking and fish and chips, they very quickly developed the British style of drug metabolism. The issue was the environment, not their genetics. As I said, you know, Kahlo was aware. So in 1962, in his first book on pharmacogenetics, he says this explicitly: if this book stresses the existence of hereditary influences on pharmacologic response, this should not be taken as an attempt to minimize the importance of the effects of internal and external environment. One may consider the total variation in the response to drugs as being caused by both hereditary and non-hereditary forces. He makes a very similar comment in the 1970s as he's doing his work where he's bending over backwards to apologize for discovering racial differences. He says, if one looks at the restaurant guide in the yellow pages of the Toronto telephone directory, one finds captions indicating the type of cuisine, starting alphabetically with American, Arabian, Armenian, Austrian, Chinese, Croatian, Cuban, Czechoslovakian, and Danish, and so on, and finishing with Vietnamese. It seems justified to assume that different people are routinely exposed to different enzyme inducers or toxic substances contained in their food and drinks. Thus, we explicitly recognize that different people are exposed to different environments, and that life in the same city does not indicate exposure to the same environment. Now, again, for Kahlo, it made perfect sense that both genetic and environmental exposures would affect your drug metabolizing enzymes, and here he invokes the same old evolutionary narratives. And if evolution were going to design a good liver, you know, what would you want it to do? You would want the liver to have some kind of hereditary tuning, so which it was pre-adapted to the prevailing toxins in an environment, but you would also want an organ that was responsive over an individual's lifetime, so that it would be able to respond to changing environmental conditions for that individual. And so he said, you know, so there has been natural selection not just for preset tuning, but also for adaptive tuning, depending on what's going on. And he said, you know, repeated exposure should lead to upregulation of metabolism of that toxin, and that's exactly what they had observed. And meanwhile, this was work that Kahlo was aware of but not actively involved with. But in the 1950s and 1960s, people who are studying patient behavior become aware of another problem that causes inter-individual variation in drug response. And that's the problem of people not taking their pills. And whether you call it non-compliance or non-adherence, it's the same problem. This is something I saw all the time when I was still doing clinical work in psychiatry, and that's what this data is from. But the basic observation is that most patients do not finish their prescriptions. And so this is a recent survey of not psychiatric non-compliance. These are rates of non-compliance, not rates of prescription completion. So 70 to 80% of people with psychoses. Overall, 20 to 50%. Most people are likely to say it's 50%. So if you give a patient a medication, they'll take half of the prescribed doses. It seems to be a uniquely American trait. Rates of compliance are much, much higher in just about every other country that's been studied. And if you look at the effect sizes of this, the effect size of this level of non-compliance dwarfs the effect size of most of the either genetic or the environmental determinants of drug response. So this is likely by far the most important predictor of therapeutic effectiveness. So this raises the general question, the sort of question that has interested people in science studies for decades, regardless of the subject they are studying, which is what determines the relative influence given to different possible explanations for some scientific phenomena. So in this case, you have the observation of inter-individual variability in drug response, and there's abundant evidence of genetic, environmental, and behavioral determinants, all of this same outcome. In the 1950s, genetics was not the dominant voice in this literature. As I said, after all, only a handful of enzyme variants were known to be relevant for a small number of drugs, and these were not drugs that were used widely. And when I was a medical student in the early 1990s, I had many discussions of the problem of non-compliance and whether you should use non-compliance versus non-adherence. It was a hot issue in the 1990s. And occasionally you'd hear discussions of the impact of diet. The one that got the most attention then was grapefruit juice. And it turns out if you eat grapefruit, it confounds the metabolism of a whole series of drugs for hypertension. But there was nothing in my medical school curriculum at all about pharmacogenetics. You know, at Harvard, a place where good research is done, wasn't part of the curriculum. And it was only when I started my clinical training in the early 2000s that pharmacogenetics had begun to take off. And if you do those sorts of the crude PubMed searches, the basic trajectory is the same. This is pharmacogenetics in general, and personalized medicine in particular, is really a product of the past decade. So then the question is, well, how can you explain the current popularity of pharmacogenetics and its racial formations? And here, this is where the history becomes relevant. Race was present in the earliest years of pharmacogenetics for a wide variety of reasons, has become firmly embedded in the data and the theory of pharmacogenetics. Sociologists and the anthropologists and all the others who have been happily benefiting from the ELSI funding associated with the Genome Project have shown the many ways in which genetics has become a wildly popular science and has had a whole series of effects on what's going on. There have been times when researchers have thought more broadly and considered that not just the genetic but also the environmental and behavioral determinants of drug response, but for the past 10 years, the focus really is narrowly on genetics. Is this due to the superior utility of genetic explanations? I don't think that's the case. As I said, the effect sizes of genetics are usually on the order of the effect size of the nutritional effects and much, much smaller than the effect size of noncompliance. Is it because environmental and behavioral factors are now known not to be relevant in a way that wasn't true in the 1990s? That's certainly not the case at all. Some of it just has to do with the broad cultural appeal of genetics. And there are many people who have analyzed how and why that has come to be. And again, this relates to some of the comments that came up earlier. Some of this has to do with how easy it is to put genetics into use, either in terms of research or in terms of practical applications. There are enormous efforts going on at present to patent and to market pharmacogenetic tests and pharmacogenetic drugs. Warfarin is the one that has gotten the most attention, but it's happening in many areas of medicine. And there's no similar effort at all to help doctors personalize medicine in other ways. No one is telling doctors how to take detailed nutritional histories and interpret them in a way that would allow them to personalize medicine based on nutritional exposures. And though there is recurring interest in helping physicians improve the compliance of their patients, that effort has been undermined by the connotations of doing that is very paternalistic and controlling, and you're not supposed to try to make your patients compliant. You're supposed to empower them in various different sorts of ways. Again, it's a peculiarly American discourse. And so there's been very little effort in making the effort needed to understand the social worlds of patients in ways that would be needed to optimize environment-based personalization or to help overcome the barriers to perfect compliance in therapeutic regimens. And so when you see these things like Homburg and Collins equating personalized medicine with genetic medicine, it's important to realize that there are very different forms that a personalized medicine can take. Inspired by history, we need to be much more imaginative if we are going to succeed in getting a truly broad-based and personalized medicine. Thank you.